Florence Nightingale was a 19th century English reformer, statistician, and many regard as the founder of modern nursing. She was born into a prominent British family when they were in Florence, Italy, which is where her first name comes from. Her father was a landowner, and her mother was a socialite who wanted the best for her daughter that was available to her during the period of Victorian England. Beginning in her late teens, Nightingale had the first of several experiences in which she believed she was called by God to do something that would help other people. And over the years, this sense of call became focused on the area of nursing. At this time, in the middle of the 19th century, nursing in England was not a respected field to go into. There were no standards of training, and nurses faced kind of constant harassment and discrimination while on the job from both doctors and patients alike. When she first talked to her family about entering the field of nursing, her parents angrily forbade her from doing so. They said that it was beneath her. But by her mid-20s, she had gathered the courage to go against her parents' wishes and enter the field anyway, going into school to be trained, and then going into hospital. This led to many years apart from her family. And she had not lived up to the expectations of her mother or her society or whatever had placed those expectations on her. Now, we probably know the name Florence Nightingale, and we know the story from here, at least some of us, that she became famous during the Crimean War, which took place in the 1850s, and was known as the Lady with the Lamp, a ministering angel, someone who took care of patients with compassion and commitment. But Nightingale was more than a compassionate soul. Among many other things, she was a brilliant mathematician. She kept statistics on sanitary conditions, causes of injury and death, medications and interventions administered, and many other quantifiable aspects at the military hospital where she was serving. Nightingale's career in nursing was also crossed by the field of education, lobbying, and writing to help make better working conditions for nurses and doctors and also patients in hospitals, to standardize training for nurses in England, and to help create the modern charting process that I'm sure all of us are familiar with when we go to the hospital or see our doctor. This life and this story is something I want us to think through as we're talking about this gospel passage from Luke. Because the word hate is a really, really strong one. And this isn't a very popular passage. It seems like we're getting some pretty difficult passages these last several weeks where I don't know if they're just trying to make pastors work harder or what, but it's kind of hard to find the redeeming quality in some of these passages. No, but hate for us is one of our strongest words. It carries with it a heavily negative emotion. Is Jesus really saying that his followers should be filled with hate for their fathers and mothers, wives and children, even for themselves? I think in some ways this passage feels like one of those impenetrable ones, ones that we often avoid on Sunday mornings or read through, you know, in our private study and just kind of think, oh, that doesn't work. So what's next? But here in this passage, the term hate doesn't imply the sense of emotion that we associate it with it today, like when someone says, I hate you. Instead, the term is used to express the action of turning away from something or detaching oneself from something else. So think about detachment as a word here, or turning away. And this is where I think Florence Nightingale's experience of being called to do something good, even against her family's wishes, comes to light. Perhaps what Jesus is even getting at here. Then Jesus goes on to say, "For which of you intending to build a tower does not first sit down and estimate the cost and make sure that you have enough to complete it? Or if you're a general in an army, don't you kind of survey the field? And if you have 10,000 soldiers and your enemy has 20,000 soldiers, it makes sense for you to try to make peace because you're probably going to get beat." As many of you know, we've recently moved to Starksboro. Leah and I purchased a house, and we're thoroughly enjoying this experience. We've been in this house now for just over a week, and we've started to set up some places that feel like home to us and other places that feel like Lowe's, just a bunch of boxes everywhere. And we still have some things here and there that we're collecting from friends and family in the area that need to make it back. Primarily, the things I'm worried about are the bees and the chickens. Now, I'm not really worried about them because they're in good hands, but I want them to kind of be home with us. Well, part of having moving chickens in is building a new coop, something that is more bear-proof than the one that we have. And so I've started that project here on Friday, and I've been working on it for 2 days. And so far, I've been to the hardware store or TSC or Home Depot or Aubuchon Hardware or True Value 5 times. And I'm just kind of allowing the inspiration of sitting in those aisles, I guess, guide me. It does feel really weird to read this passage when Jesus is saying, like, if you're going to do something, like, shouldn't you be planning ahead? Or, like, because these bills for this chicken coop are starting to add up pretty quickly, and I have a floor and one wall done, and, like, there are more walls that need doing. But I think that maybe something, Jesus is alluding to something very different here. I think of this chicken coop thing as an adventure, kind of a time where I get to experience this, because it's not often that I get to build a chicken coop, and they're fun to build. I think Jesus here is not talking necessarily about an adventure. In fact, I think he's warning his disciples that what they're doing is not an adventure, that this is really perilous work. As we know where this story is taking place in Luke's gospel, they're walking toward Jerusalem. And we know what's happened there, but in the story, the people don't know what's going to happen. It's a very dangerous place. And their lives, Jesus' followers' lives, will be put in great risk. So when he's talking about following Jesus, following him, he's trying to provide a reality check here. Do you really know what you're getting into? Because this might cost you the safety net that your parents and Jesus' society provided. An extended family was the safety net. Or this might cost you the legacy, which is your children, again, in this society. And then this last verse, he talks about giving up all of your possessions, being detached from the material things that his disciples, probably like us, use to define an aspect of our lives. I think that's been maybe another insight into moving, which is just how much stuff. I'm sure those who helped us move could attest to quite well. There are a lot of books, and there are a lot of things that we have, and we don't really know why we have them anymore. And there are a number of things that we've gone through in this last week and realized that we either don't need this or we need it like once every 5 years. But regardless, it cost us money at some point. It costs our resources to purchase. And it's made me think about what it means to be attached to so much stuff. I think that Jesus is talking about that. How are we going to define these aspects of our lives when we might have something more important to do? How do we use our resources, like our time or our influence or our money, to make some sort of good in the world? And that, to me, is kind of this question that he's trying to ask. What is the true cost of following Jesus? Makes me wonder if this whole Christianity thing or living by faith experience that we're trying to do here or in our daily lives is actually hard. What if, you know, to be committed to the good of others or to work for lifting up the downtrodden or to fight injustice or to live by faith, trusting that God is still at work in a world like this, what if that's actually pretty costly? What if our faith calls on us to make an estimate of our faith's overall cost, to examine our lives and our time and our resources and take account on how they're being used? I'm not just talking about like giving to church. I'm talking about how we think about our lives here in this world, to see if we, followers of Jesus Christ, are indeed making this world better, more loving and just, or if we're just kind of accumulating stuff around the house. Wendell Berry once said, "Don't own so much clutter that you will be relieved when your house catches fire." And as someone who recently moved, I feel like I have a lot of clutter. But I think that this story is perhaps one of the most difficult ones in our gospel. This idea that this stuff doesn't really matter. What matters most is that we're using our resources to help each other, and to help those in our neighborhood, and to help those who are less fortunate or oppressed or are injured here in this world. I like Mary Oliver's poem, Thirst, because I think it helps me with passages like this one. You know, this line, "Grant me in your mercy a little more time." I think that works for me. That there's so much to this life of faith that we don't get right away. That it is a life of faith that continues on and on and on. So we just ask for a little more time, that we may live true to Jesus' calling. May the words of Jesus work on us a little this week. May the Spirit of God guide our hearts and minds. May we consider the cost of discipleship, the call God places on our hearts to do good and to be good in a world that truly needs good. Amen.